We begin this evening with this piece from writer Elizabeth Bowen about the atmosphere at a neo-Gothic extravaganza in Mitchelstown, County Cork, hosted by George Kingston and attended by the aristocracy and gentry from all of the surrounding southern counties. The date was the significant 4th of August, 1914.
For miles round, each isolated big house had disgorged its talker. The first day of the war. The tensions of months, of years, outlying tensions of Europe, inner tensions of Ireland, broke in a spate of words. These were the unmarshalled loyalists of the South. Not a family had not put out its generation of military brothers. Tablets in Protestant churches recorded deaths in remote battles, swords hung in halls. If the Anglo-Irish live on, and for a myth, for that myth they constantly shed their blood. So, on this August 1914, day of grandeur and gravity, the ascendancy rallied, renewed itself.
An extract from Bowen's Court, Elizabeth Bowen's autobiography. Well, World War I not only cost millions of lives, but it would also reshape the social and political landscape of Europe. In country houses throughout Ireland and Britain, it changed patterns of life that have been going on for centuries. I'm joined by Professor Terry Dooley, Director of the Centre for the Study of Historic Irish Houses and Estates, and Dr. Chris Ridgway, Curator of the Castle Howard Stately Home in North Yorkshire. He joins us on the line from York. So, Terry, let's start with country houses at the commencement of World War One. Who were the people who lived in these country houses by 1914?
Well, first of all, I mean, I suppose these are the ancestral homes of the landlord class, predominantly built from the early 18th century onwards. Now, the shape of Irish society had changed dramatically by the outbreak of the Great War, so that the landed class had basically lost their great estates, which had maintained these houses for generations. So by the outbreak of the Great War in 1914, you had country houses which were essentially isolated from their great landed estates. How many there were, it's difficult to actually determine, but there was probably in the region of about 4,000 or 5,000 of them in the 19th century. And of those, approximately about 160 or 170 belonged to the Irish aristocracy. The aristocracy were obviously at the top of the landed hierarchy, but again, as a result of the breakup of their landed estates and the loss of their political and economic power since the late 19th century, they would have found themselves in very changed circumstances on the 4th of August 1914.
But there was a tradition of military service in Irish aristocratic families, wasn't there?
Absolutely, and particularly in the case of younger sons. It was expected that obviously the heir would inherit the estate. Many heirs did serve in the army before they took over the management of the estate itself. But second sons, third sons and so on, it would have been laid out for them essentially that they were, or that they would be expected to pursue a military career.
And how did aristocrats in Ireland and in Britain, perhaps as well, respond to the outbreak of the war? Did they see it as a necessity, joining in and joining the call, as it were, in order to reassert their authority or to reassert their position?
Well, first of all, I mean, they would have still regarded themselves as part of a much wider supranational aristocratic class, part of the wider British aristocracy. As I said, their circumstances had changed so much over the previous 30 or 40 years or so that many of them would have perceived this as an opportunity to once again put themselves to the forefront. And certainly they responded to the war in a way that was expected of them, and it was expected of the aristocracy in Britain as a whole. So, I mean, we have to consider the fact that, you know, many of these people or many of these men were already serving officers in the British Army at the outbreak of war. Then they respond in a variety of different ways thereafter. Some of those who had left their regiments rejoined them. Those who were too old organised recruitment drives, for example, up and down the country, while their wives would have involved themselves in a variety of activities, such as the organisation of charitable events to provide parcels for the men at the front, to organise funding for ambulances, etc. But it was a very important time for them, in the sense that, I mean, the 4th of August is that watershed period where they consider that possibly this is a new way forward. in an Ireland that has become, you know, divided on political religious lines. And in fact, in an Ireland on the 4th of August 1914, where this threat of civil war is looming because of developments in the province of Ulster since 1912.
Chris Ridgway, the Howards of Castle Howard, I suppose there was no more aristocratic family in Britain than that family.
They would typify exactly that kind of aristocratic family. A grand house, a long ancestry, deep roots in Yorkshire, and all members of the family responded to the call of duty, as they saw it on the 4th of August, in different ways. We had a younger son who returned from farming in Canada to join his old regiment and go straight out to the front. We had the chatelaine of the house, the Dowager Countess, who refused to turn Castle Howard over as a divisional headquarters because she was so opposed to the military. So this was an untypical reaction, you might say, amongst the aristocracy. But then her younger son, who was in Asquith's cabinet, a Liberal parliament, he was so ashamed by this that he then joined up and went to the front himself. And this is a man who had a glass eye and was therefore manifestly not well equipped to be a fighting soldier.
Tell us about the experience of a man called James Prest, who worked on the family farm, because his experience might have been typical of some of the employees of the aristocracy.
Yes, one of the great results of the research that's come out across these exhibitions in Yorkshire is the chance to tell the story of ordinary people whose documentary record is inevitably not as complete as those of the grand families. Now, James Prest was a younger son on a farm on the estate. He joined up and served in the trenches, and then in March 1918, he was captured and spent the rest of the war as a prisoner of war in occupied Belgium, put to work doing labouring chores and things like that. But remarkably, he kept a tiny little diary, 5 by 2 inches, in which he recorded his experiences. So to have this sort of very unusual and precious little document has been a wonderful result of this research that's been going on with these projects in Yorkshire.
Now, whatever about people working on the estates enlisting, the writer Owen Curry, who has a great interest in these matters, contends that employees were put under pressure to become volunteers and to enlist. Let's take a listen to this example.
In North Leinster, a lot of the families of those who died were put under a fair bit of pressure because their fathers were employed in large houses. There was an expectation that if you were in the workforce, that you would show your loyalty by providing a son to go to the war. When the war was going to be quick and over by Christmas, that wasn't a big deal. But when bodies started coming back, it did raise big questions. In Selbridge Graveyard, one of the few bodies of an Irish soldier who died at the front was brought back for burial. His father was a groom in Castletown House. It's one of the aspects of the war that hasn't been spoken about. When you talked to the families afterwards, they didn't see World War I as some sort of heroic, noble effort, even fighting for the rights of small nations, which became an issue after the sack of Louvain. They saw it as basically a family squabble between King George V and his cousin, and they felt aggrieved that they had been asked to supply fodder for the trenches as part of this.
Terry, would you agree with that? Do you think it's a valid thesis that there was pressure put on the sons of the employees of these landed estates to go to war?
Well, it's very interesting, and I would suggest rather contentious. I've been looking for documented evidence of this for a long, long time, and I really haven't come up with very much. Except you would get the occasional report in newspapers, such as the report referring to the Earl of Meath at Kilruddery, encouraging some of his estate employees to go to the war on the condition that their jobs would remain open for them when they would return.
One of whom would have been Gay Byrne's father.
That's exactly, I thought that would have been an interesting angle to actually pursue in that particular documentary. But obliging them is another matter, or putting them under obligation to go to the front is a completely different matter. And, you know, I would certainly like to see the evidence of that. But I'm not suggesting that it didn't happen.
But
I can't prove it. Mm. Yeah.
Chris, how would you react? How would you respond to that notion, that thesis?
There were very mixed responses. I mean, I think there will undoubtedly have been instances of pressure, either implicit or explicit, on workforces, both, you know, on landed estates or perhaps in companies and businesses and factories. I think generally the response was that people were encouraged to enlist. But again, the ninth Countess of Carlisle at Castle Howard, she chose her words very carefully. She said she did not wish to place any obstacle in the way of men who wished to enlist, but she was not going to go any further than that. But by late 1915, 1916, when clearly there are really immense manpower issues at the front, her tune, as did many other people's, changed, where she felt that there was a moral duty for people to join the war effort. And I think that's different than the kind of pressure, the social pressure, if you like, that from the quotation that you read out. I think that there became a more national consensus about having to join up, unpleasant and difficult as that was for many, many people.
And you mentioned Michael Howard, who lived in Canada and who returned to rejoin his regiment. What was his fate?
Very, very sad, but I mean, quite typical. He went missing in action in Passchendaele in 1917. His family have one version of what happened to him. We have in the archives at Castle Howard official communications that list him as being lost in an advance. His body never recovered, and so he is one of the thousands of names of people who have no known grave marked on the Tynecott Memorial just outside of Ypres.
Terry, let's talk about one of Ireland's premier aristocratic families, the Dukes of Leinster, which who would have been in, to some extent the equivalent, if you like, of the occupants of Castle Howard, the Howard family. Tell us about the military career of Desmond Fitzgerald.
Well, Desmond was the second son of the fifth Duke of Leinster. He was actually heir presumptive to the estate itself because his older brother Maurice had been institutionalised in an asylum in Edinburgh. For about 4 or 5 years before the outbreak of the Great War. But he was a career soldier and in 1914 went to the front with the Irish Guards, had been wounded on two or three occasions, was highly decorated and so on. But in 1916, during what was intended to be really a harmless grenade-throwing practice, he was with the Roman Catholic chaplain, Father Lane Fox. And Father Lane Fox threw a hand grenade. He may have held on to it too long or the fuse may have been defective, but whatever the reason, the grenade exploded. It badly injured Father Lane Fox, but unfortunately it killed Lord Desmond. Now, at that stage, I mean, Lord Desmond, just two or three nights previously, had actually dined with the Prince of Wales, who later described him as his greatest ever friend. And the Prince of Wales, who his father, King George, was trying to keep away from the front, had come to an arrangement with Kitchener to go to the Middle East. And he had put in a request that Lord Desmond Fitzgerald would come with him as his equerry. But Lord Desmond was too junior, and therefore he was prevented from doing so. And 3 or 4 days later, then Desmond is killed. But it's the repercussions of his death that are significant and very, very interesting.
What were they?
Well, in the sense that his younger brother, Edward, who had also fought in the war and who was discharged honourably, he was something of a rake, so to speak, and had been bankrupt. He had entered into an agreement with a speculator, Henry Malaby Deely, under which Malaby Deely agreed to pay off his bankruptcy, but on the condition that if he inherited the estate as the Duke of Leinster, then the estate and the proceeds from the investments would become the property of Henry Malaby Deely. In the event, Desmond, of course, was killed at Calais in 1916, and Maurice died prematurely in the asylum in Edinburgh in 1922. So, directly as a result, therefore, of Desmond's death, the estate passes to the younger son and is consequently lost to the Fitzgeralds.
And what had Carton House been used for during the war?
It was inhabited as a private residence by the brother's uncle, Lord Frederick, who was the chief trustee of the estate and had been since the death of the fifth Duke and his wife in the late 19th century.
And he allowed the National Volunteers to drill in the estate?
He did indeed. Very soon after the outbreak of the war, he invited the Minute Company of the Irish National Volunteers to drill on the domain. And I think the presumption being that, you know, many of them would take up the call to arms and they would enlist in the army. But, I mean, this was very much part of what was happening and aristocratic attitudes in the aftermath, particularly of Redmond's Wooden Bridge and House of Commons speeches, that they write to the newspapers in support of what Redmond has said and, you know, urging people to essentially come together in this important matter. That fades away quite quickly afterwards. But Fitzgerald was one of the first to actually open the domain for drilling purposes or training purposes.
Chris, as the war progressed, obviously there was weariness, there was disillusionment. Did that reflect itself in the big houses, or did the aristocracy remain faithful to the cause?
They remained faithful to the cause, I mean, but you're quite right, weariness, disillusionment. I mean, again, at Castle Howard, Rosalind Howard, the Countess, says by 1916, we didn't think war would still be going on, but we have to see it through to the grim end. But equally, she became very suspicious of state control. I mean, that the government was intruding in more and more areas of civilian life. The Defence of the Realm Act had been issued 8 days after the outbreak of war and affected all areas of life, from rationing to movement around the country and so on. And for liberal people like her and other intellectuals, they became deeply suspicious of, as it were, the centralisation of authority in the country. And you find outbursts against this.
Terry, at Maynooth, I think you're creating a database of members of the Irish landed class who served and died in the war. How do you decide who's eligible for inclusion in that database?
Well, at this stage, we've been working on it now for over a year or so, Fidelma Byrne and Nora Brown and David Gahan. And what we have done is we have mapped out the houses that were in existence in Ireland at the outbreak of the Great War, and then taking it from the head of the family and moving out then to sons and then to other related members of the extended family. So if you take, for example, the case of the aristocracy, we have 164 aristocratic families at this stage. Number of those families who had serving members in the war, about 139. Mm. The number of individual participants from the family, just over 700, and the numbers killed around about 140. So it's roughly one in five actually comes home. But I would emphasise that, you know, this is not definitive just yet.
Terry Dooley and Chris Ridgway, many thanks indeed for joining us this evening. Terry and Chris will be among the speakers at The Country House and the Great War, the European Experience, a conference which takes place this Thursday and Friday at NUI Maynooth. And you can check out our website for full details.